We're thankful this morning as we are continuing and even concluding our Sanctity of Life month. You got them or do I got them? Our Sanctity of Life month, we're thankful this morning to get to conclude. We've had Micah Selfin, our evangelist friend of the 1040 window. And then we've also had, beyond that, we had dear Dinah with us talking about the issue of not only human trafficking, but also the situation just right here in our own backyard in Dayton. And many of you have already been involved with that. We're thankful to have last week Seth Dreyer with us with Created Equal, talking about the issue of abortion. How do we understand it? How we understand the humanity and the horrors of it, and how do we discuss that and stand clearly on that? We're concluding now the month as we've gone through Sanctity of Life. We talk about womb to tomb issues. We wanted to conclude the month with special friends. We've had people in from the county before. We've had people in from different organizations before. We're thankful this morning to get to conclude with some of our own. Sterling and Sonda Williams, if you don't know them, you can get to know them, and Mr. Jim running around with them as well. And so we're thankful they're here this morning. The topic we're discussing this morning with them is the issue of foster care and adoption. And they have had just a little bit of experience about it, right? Just a little bit. Yeah. So as you guys are up here, we're going to go through just a few thoughts, a few questions that we wanted to walk through as well. And so let's start here with both of you can talk. There's no fight needed. So whichever you want to start. What started you down the process of foster care and adoption? So whichever one wants to start, raise your mic and just let us know.
I guess we'll talk about adoption first because that's where we actually started. When we got to Japan, being in the Air Force, we were transferred from Thailand to Japan, and we were trying to have a child, and I guess God wasn't ready for us to have one yet, but we joined a church when we first got to Japan with, it was just the beginning of a church, and there was a missionary that was heading it up that had been there for like 30 years. And we happened to mention at one time with him that we were thinking about adopting because things weren't going well for us to have our own. And he put us in contact with another missionary who had a compound up in Sendai, northern Japan. And they had adopted, I think there were seven families in the compound, and they had adopted about 125 or so children between the seven families. And what's interesting is this time that we're going through Sanctity of Life. The reason we have our two boys is because this doctor, Japanese doctor, believed in the sanctity of life.
Wow.
And this is how these families were able to adopt their children, because he would pay for the birth and the care after and everything, and that providing that the woman would allow him to place the child in a home that would take care of them. Back in the early 70s, if you were born out of wedlock, you had no rights in Japan. You could not attend any government schools, gain any government aid whatsoever. So to make a long story shorter, we got in contact with them. We went there and met with the families. They had never given up a child before. And about 6 months later, I think they called and said, "We have a child for you if you would like." Mm-hmm. And of course, we jumped on it. But that was our first adoption. And then about maybe another 6 or 10 months later, they called and said they had another child for us, mm-hmm, if we'd like. And those were our first two children.
So at a really convenient season, overseas, young in the military.
Yeah. Sort of.
So adopted the two sons, right?
We started the process, mm-hmm. and fortunately, I worked with a gentleman that spoke very good English. He was a local national, and when we went to court, he went with us and did all the interpreting for us for those two. And then
within probably a year, less than a year, we only had one car, so Sterling took a car to work, and I was stuck at home. And he went to the thrift shop and got two strollers and wired them together, and I would wander around the base pushing my two sons to try to pass the time. And one day I came home from my walk, and here was a very pregnant Japanese woman sitting on my porch. And she says, "I've been watching you, and these are your children?" And I said, "Yes." And she stood up and said, "I'm going to have a child, and I would like you to take it. If you don't, I'll kill it." So needless to say, that was no question in our mind right. What to do. I got on the phone. I brought her in the house, got on the phone and said, "Sterling, you have to get home right now." So that was our third adopted child. And then shortly after that time, within a month, we found out that we were expecting our own. So we went to Japan.
That's the old adage, you adopt three and then you have your own.
So we went to Japan with no children, and 4.5 years later we came back with four. And so that was...
Give everybody the ages. How old were you all, and what was the span then? So by the time when you went to when you came back and added all these kids?
We were 30.
31?
Mm-hmm. I don't remember.
34.
But
we were in our 30s.
And we were only gone 4.5 years. And that all happened in 4.5 years. Of course, we had to go back home. And he was released from the military, not because of the kids, but because his time was up. And we decided we had to go home. And Jim and Melva had never seen our children. My parents had made one trip out. And so we decided the children needed to meet their grandparents, get settled. And so we went back to California and with our new family.
What were the age range of the kids at that point when you
all within 3.5 years? We had four under 3.5. Yeah.
So easy, in other words.
Easy,
right.
Yes.
Easy. Foreign country.
I didn't have any problem.
I bet you did. Oh, more overtime. Shucks. Oh, man. So then maybe let's transition. Obviously, that's a significant time in your all's life. Four kids, young married, back home after serving overseas. You come back here. How do you end up going to, help the congregation know, was that your last adoption, and how did you end up in foster care?
Well, it turned out to not be our last adoption, but I had an opportunity to come to Wright Pat, transfer from the Naval Shipyard that I was working on in submarines, and I'm just not built for submarines. But we jumped at the chance to come to Ohio, doing the same job I did while I was in the service. So we transitioned from Napa, California to Trotwood. And when we left Napa, we sold our home. And it was just a real small little two-bedroom home. But we sold it and came out here, and we were able to buy a huge bi-level in Trotwood. We were just flabbergasted at the size of the house we were able to purchase for the same price that we sold our home in Napa. And we got settled in there, and we had this huge home and had like five bedrooms. And so one day we were watching television and we saw an advertisement for foster parents. And we kind of looked at each other and thought, my goodness, we got this huge home. let's look into that. And so we did, and we went through all of the paperwork, and some of you that have been in foster care know all the paperwork, the home inspections, and diving into your finances, and all of those things. So we got through all of that, and it wasn't, but it's, in fact, I think almost the day we got our license, we got a call for our first foster child, and I'll let you talk about that.
Well, the first one that came to our home was 11-year-old girl from a abusive and sexually abusive incestual home, and so she came, and she was one that stayed with us the longest, almost 6 years, and I learned after that experience that it doesn't matter what age they are, every child needs you. A lot of people say, oh, teenagers are so terrible, but they need you. And then other ones say, oh, babies, I couldn't take babies. Well, they need you. And toddlers are terrible twos, oh my gosh, but they need you.
No, you're wrong there. I'll just step in.
Well, you know more about that.
I'm kidding.
So she came to our home and stayed a long time. And once she got there and got settled, and we got settled, then the children started coming, and they just kept coming and coming. And there, we had our five, and we had room for another five. The agency licensed us four, so we were full.
So did it fluctuate between, obviously, your five to as many as
10?
As 10.
Yes.
As 10. What was that like? So I think some of them are sitting out here, you know, and I get people are getting married later. They're having less kids if they're having kids. I mean, that's national statistics. So somebody hears, you did what? You not only got five of your own, but then you took in five. Mm-hmm. What was it like back then? Tell us some of the joys, but some of the challenges of taking in having adopted kids, biological kids, rotating to some degree, foster kids, all the way up to 10 people under 18 in your household. Mm-hmm. Tell us some of the great joys, some of the great problems, some of the great challenges maybe.
I don't know that when we were going through that time of transition with kids coming and going, and ours were still fairly young. They really didn't really know any difference when kids would come in and stay for a while, and then they'd leave, and maybe some others would come. But we never really, I don't remember any time that we had really any troubles or struggles other than, you know, normal issues with siblings. They were all siblings in our eyes. They were all our children, and they were all brothers and sisters, and our kids, our own kids, really accepted them well. So we didn't have any real issues there. But I think some of the joys we had is we insisted on the kids going to a private school, a Christian school. And the caseworker came out one day on a normal visit and asked how the kids are doing in school and where were they going. And we told them they were going to a Christian school, and they said, oh no, you can't send them to a private or Christian school. And we said, well, then I guess you'll have to come pack them up and take them back. And I said, well, we just won't talk about it. And so.
So for 20 years, they didn't talk about it.
That's
we
awesome.
Talk about
they graduated
awesome.
From Christian schools. And
that's awesome.
Yes. I think the thing that I remember most is when you have that many children, you have to have a washer and dryer that lasts forever. And it ran from morning till night.
And we had one son that said, I'll do all the wash, because he wanted to make sure he had his clothes. So he did all the wash.
Yes. And so God just made our washer and dryer last 20 plus years at 2 and 3 loads a day. And we, to keep up, the joys that I remember is having a clothesline. The whole backyard was nothing but one giant clothesline, and all the girls and I would take the clothes and hang them all out, and the boys would take them all down, and then they'd all sit on the floor and fold up their clothes and put them in their baskets and put them away. And that to me is a joy. Another joy is, and I think God expects us to have an abundant life. That doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be not be messy.
Right.
It's going to be messy. But to just enjoy life and share what we need to share as Christian adults and parents, the greatest joy I had is every summer we would go camping with, and we would take over the campground.
Rain
and it was
amazing.
It was amazing.
You were those people.
Yes. And we'd put up our clothesline and we'd hang our clothes out. And sometimes several years we went for a month, like a road trip across the United States in our giant van. But I think also the worries was, how do we feed 12 people every night? Where do we get a van or a vehicle that will take all of us together? And what do we do when we go on vacation and the agency hasn't got the okay for one or two of the children? We made up our mind from the beginning that we were not going to, they are ours, and we're going as a family. So many times it would take us months to plan a vacation where all of us could go and reroute our route and this and that and the other thing till the parents agreed and the agency agreed.
That's awesome.
At that time you had a 50-mile radius. You couldn't go outside that 50-mile radius without parental approval. And so sometimes it was a struggle to get that approval. Sometimes we didn't. So like she said, we had to kind of change our plans and try to stay local. But one time we did take, I guess there were nine kids we took to Yellowstone. So that was a long trip. But it was a lot of fun.
The kids remember that.
Yeah.
Of all the things that we've done as a family, the kids remember those times that they just got to be kids.
Right.
They didn't have to be perfect little children. They didn't have to be in school. They just got to be kids.
I think one of the other great joys that we received from our foster time was that all of the kids that came into our home, obviously, they went to the Christian school. They attended church, you know, 3 times a week. They participated in our bus ministry. And we were able to see everyone that was old enough and understood got saved while we were had them. And so it gives us peace about, when they left, at least they knew Jesus and they had experienced a time where there was no strife. They didn't have to worry about where their next meal would come from, where they were going to sleep that night. And so that brought us a lot of joy, knowing that we had planted a seed in them that they could take with them when they left.
It's awesome.
Yeah, and for eternity, because some of our foster children are gone. They live in heaven now, and if they had had that time and God had given us the opportunity to take them to church and be with their Christian peers and things, you don't know where they'd be.
Another thing I think about that brings us, has brought us a lot of joy is that when these children leave, the county says no contact. We can't make contact with any of the kids. Even if we were to locate them, by law, we're not allowed to contact them. But they could contact us. And we've had several over the past 25 years reach out to us, a sibling group, JJ and Mike, called us one New Year's, the first time they called on New Year's Eve, well, New Year's Day, it was about 1:30 in the morning, they called and said, "Hey, how you doing? We just, you know, what? Who are you?"
And then that became a habit that they did every year.
Every year. So now we just wait up for it, you know. But several have come back and are reunited with our family. And of course, one is one that you've prayed for several months through breast cancer and all that. So.
It's incredible. It's an incredible thing. So you've told us about the really good times. How did you navigate the less than good times as a couple in your marriage and then in the family? How'd you navigate it?
I don't think we had time.
Or strength.
No time to fight.
Or
not
strength.
Yeah.
I don't recall any real difficult times. We had one foster girl that came to us that we had to call the county and say, come and get her, because she was just out of control, and she pushed our daughter down a flight of stairs, and we said, oh, that's not going to work, and so we had to call them, but struggles maybe. Are we going to have enough food this week? Is the car going to get us to church and school and work? And I think those were the biggest struggles that I recall.
I think you have to remember that when we went into foster care, that was 40 years ago. A lot of things have changed in 40 years, including the climate of our country. And so we, with our international family, foster care loved it because they could put anybody in there and you just become another member of the international family. And but I think one of the biggest struggles we had is people who didn't understand that God sees us all the same, and that we just have to open up our hearts and we're all one person. We're the family of God, and we had some trouble, not in our marriage or anything, but with people who didn't understand. And I think that gave me the most stress of all.
And I know you like this story, so I'm going to tell it.
It's one of my favorite stories of all time from anyone. Go ahead.
We were celebrating one of the kids' birthdays. I don't recall which one it was, but we took them to Spaghetti Warehouse downtown Dayton. And I think we had all 10 kids with us. And so I brought the van up, they unloaded, and I went and parked, and we had our meal, and I went out and got because you couldn't park anywhere close to Spaghetti Warehouse, so I had to go and get the van, and I pulled up in front of it, and I got out, and I opened the doors, and I was herding all these kids in, and all of a sudden, this lady started screaming, "You're taking my child!" And I looked around, sorry, just trying to get our kids in the van. Well, I thought, sure, I was going to jail.
From foster care to kidnapping, just like that.
Just like that.
You guys already mentioned it, challenging the sense of people not understanding. I imagine just the prejudice that you experienced. But then the system was much different then. In some ways, I think worse than it is now. I think they've made a lot of steps and improvements in some ways. So it was challenging more so when you all were pioneers. I know you wouldn't feel that title and wouldn't want that title, but what was it like back then? Because I know now a kid's not to be in care more than 2 years before they have to be adopted somewhere, put somewhere, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there's a litany of programs available for help and support, schooling, medical, et cetera. What was it like back then when you guys entered? I mean, was it just there's people just trying to place people and not much else?
That's pretty much what it was. If you had an opening, they were going to fill it. And many times I'd be at work and I'd get the call and say they had a child for us. So I'd say, well, let me talk to the wife and then I'll call you back. And so I'd call her and you know, we just couldn't turn them down. So we'd take them as long as we had space. But I think you're right, there's been a lot of changes, but I don't think much has really changed. They'd put the kids in our home, and as long as they were satisfied, they were happy. We've seldom heard from a caseworker. I mean, until that Senate Bill 89 was passed, we'd keep them until, I mean, some would stay 6 months, some would stay 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. And so when the Senate Bill 89 came out, they had 18 months, supposedly.
Allegedly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that seldom worked. But support from the county, I hope they're not listening, but was not very good. I mean,
good news, that's radically, no, it hasn't changed.
Yeah. So I don't think that's changed. I think the caseworkers are terribly overloaded, and as long as there's not a problem with a family, they probably work with the families they got problems with. Mm-hmm. And I think the thing that we have to remember as foster parents is, you know, these kids are coming into our home, and if they're, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, in that age group, when they come into our home, they're asking, what did we do? You know, did we do something wrong? I can fix it. I'll be good. I'll be better. And 99.9 times out of 10 or 100, it wasn't their fault, obviously.
Right.
It's the parents' fault. And to try to explain that to them was sometimes really difficult.
Yeah. How do you handle that level
of understand?
Yeah, that rejection, that, you know,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
So how did you all handle the injustices? Because along the way, there had to be some injustices between caseworkers, the DA, the state, BIOS. There had to be some injustices. How'd you work through that with the Lord and each other?
Well, if you know me, I'm going to speak my mind. And that
Please.
Got, and yes, I know, everybody knows that. But I thought somebody has to fight for the children. And so we had some injustices that we felt very strongly about. And I was known for the one that would said, okay, I'll give you 3 hours and you can come back and get the children, we'll pack up. I never intended, ever expected that they would ever say, okay, because they were so overloaded that,
right.
And so they didn't approach us with a whole lot of problems. But when there was an injustice, we handled it, we were their advocate, we found some way to work around it. I know our kids went to Christian school all that time, and you just, it's kind of like the devil, you know, resist the devil and he'll flee from you. And so it kind of worked the same way with Children's Services. If we resisted, they just said, well, we don't see it then. We won't talk about it. So that helped, because then you could continue doing what you knew was right and for the children's benefit. We had one really difficult situation, and God just literally in a few hours just turned it completely around, and you can tell them about that.
Our youngest daughter that we chose to adopt. We had her from just about birth, and we told the county, and she was of a large sibling group who had been abused and had multiple fathers, and it was just a real mess. So we expressed our desire to adopt her. And at the time that we took her as a placement, everything seemed fine. They were okay with that. And after about 3 years, we finally started pushing the fact that we wanted to adopt her. And all of a sudden they came back and said, although she is biracial, we are required to place her in a all African American home. And that got my jaws tight, and I said, well, we'll see about that. And I immediately contacted a lawyer. He was a child advocate attorney, had been doing it for 30 years. And I approached him and explained the situation, and he said, you just go home, I will take care of this. And a week later, we
got the paperwork.
Wow.
You know, the children come into your home not knowing what's going on. They blame themselves. They've come from they don't know where their next meal's coming from,
where they're going to
sleep, whether you like them, whether you don't like them. Do they know that I like chocolate milk and not white milk? There are all those worries, and we have to erase all those and give them peace. And then, but then when they have to leave, I'm worried the same thing about the next place they're going to. And so write down everything that they like, write down everything, you know. Tell them where they like to eat. Tell them they get ice cream on their birthday, they expect that. And so those are the things that worry us as foster parents. And getting into foster parenting is tough, but somebody's got to do it, and we're equipped to do it. As Christian parents, we're equipped to do this, and if God tells you that, gives you that ministry, then you got to do it.
So on that note, what would you say, man, woman, couple, younger, older, kids, no kids, what would each of you say to somebody who's thinking about, you know, they hear it and they are like, nope, not, you said it fits my ministry? Oh, check out. Nope, it wasn't. Yeah. What would you say to somebody listening right now, man, woman, couple, young, old, what would each of you tell them about foster care or adoption?
I think the first thing I would say to a couple would be that you both have to be on the same page. You both have to have the same desires for fostering. And if you don't, then I would step back and hold off until such time as you both have the same desires, and understand that it's not easy. Fostering is a lot of work. It's a lot of heartache when the children leave. But it's such a blessing to have them and to see them grow and to see them respond to us, to others, to church family, and it's really a joy, and the joy well outdoes the heartache.
And I think if fostering and adoption isn't your piece of cake, then there's lots of people in the church that are doing that, and you can join hands with them. I remember we had, our church family just was so wonderful for us, even though they knew that they couldn't do that. And they'd say, we're going to Kings Island. We'd like to take the teenage boys with us. And we'd say, good.
Amen.
The boys need it. We need it. King Island needs it. So, and then another family would say, we're going to go to Young's Dairy. We'd like to take the little kids with us. And that's wonderful. Because, you know, as parents, you don't get a whole lot of time by yourself. And so it was nice that the kids got their time, we got our time, And just to love up your own kids, and just to love up your own kids, you can imagine what it makes us feel like when you're loving up our kids. So whether it's biological kids, adoptive kids, foster kids, all kids need love. And so just love up all the kids. If this isn't your bag, find us that have these children and love them up for us. So they know that this is their place.
Right, right. In a world, their world that's been filled with uncertainty and rejection, finding stability and acceptance and love and care, not only at home, but then even in a church environment. Mm-hmm. That's huge. That's huge. I know you guys wouldn't say this and wouldn't want to brag about it at all, but just help them know just what I want the congregation to hear this just so they get what's capable. In total, how many adopted, how many fostered over the years?
We have 4 adopted, and I think over the 20 plus years of fostering, we had 37 come through our home.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you hear that? 4 adopted, 37, and then I think...
One biological.
The medical child, right? Yeah, yeah.
She's the hero. She shared us.
Yeah, she went through the whole process, yeah. Yes. But I want to highlight something. You said it quickly. Over 20 years, mm-hmm. when did you all finally relinquish your license? How old were you all, if you don't mind me asking?
I have to think of this.
Do the quick math.
It was...
We were 55 when we stopped.
So it's been 20 years since we stopped. We were in it for about 21, and then we've been out of it for just about the same amount.
Right.
Now our foster children are grandparents.
Yeah.
Yes. And so awesome. We're great-grandparents to those kids.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So I wanted to just highlight that for that reason. Sometimes I think we have these tidy tracks in our lives, you know, American culture, and it's not necessarily wrong, but there's these tidy tracks. In your mid-50s, you're supposed to be doing this or not doing this. And you were still accepting strangers into your home in your 50s, mm-hmm. And I say that just to try to encourage us that there's always an opportunity, there's always a time to be able to serve the Lord in very unique ways when you're single, when you're married, if you have kids, you don't have kids, mm-hmm. you have kids that aren't yours, kids that become yours, et cetera, all the way on. So I really want to say I appreciate that.
The only reason we stopped is because we felt the Lord was calling us to go to Brazil and help a missionary there. And so we had to finally wait for the last child to leave, then we sold our home and everything and went to Brazil. So I think if that hadn't happened, we probably would have still been in foster care. So.
That's incredible. That's incredible. I appreciate you all taking the time this morning. I know it's always a little nerve-wracking, right? So I appreciate you taking the time. Church, it's not about them and for their ego, but just as a sign of appreciation, would you let them know you're thankful by giving them a round of applause? Can you stay the mics? Buddy is already thinking, oh man, amen, so glad, and we're out early. Not so lucky, friends. Give me 10 minutes. Would you do that? Give me 10 minutes and meet me in Luke chapter number 10. I want to wrap up Sanctity of Life Month. I'm so thankful to have had the Williams, and it's helpful for what we're considering this morning, Luke chapter number 10. And I want you to just join me just for a few moments to consider, how do we wrap this up? If we've talked about the great need in the 1040 window and beyond for the gospel, and then just all that takes place, unfortunately, in the horrors of humanity that happen over there, if we've talked about the issues of trafficking in our own backyard, if we've talked about the plight and the atrocity of abortion in our nation, 53 million citizens murdered, and now we talk about foster care and adoption, kids who cannot stay in their home or have not been wanted in their home, it can leave us in a little bit of a lurch of like, so what do we do about it? You know, I'm not Superman. I don't have $1 million. I can't do everything. And it can feel a little frustrating and defeating to think I don't really have a next step. So what, right? So I want to try to challenge and encourage us real quick. Look at Luke chapter 10. And look at verse 29. If you're familiar with the Bible, somebody's approached Jesus and basically said, who do I have to love? And Jesus said, love your neighbor. And he didn't love it. So what did he say? Yeah, but who's my neighbor? I mean, really. I mean, quantify this for me, Jesus. Give me specificity. So Jesus gives him a parable, verse 29. But he, willing to justify himself, asked Jesus, who's my neighbor? And Jesus answering said, a certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among thieves, which stripped him of his raiment and wounded him and departed, leaving him half dead. And you can put this in air quotes in your mind, and by chance there came a certain priest that way. And when he saw him, he passed over on the other side. And likewise, a Levite, when he was at the place, came and looked at him and passed by on the other side. But a certain Samaritan, as he journeyed, came where he was, and when he saw where he was, he had compassion on him. And he went to him, bound up his wounds, pouring in oil and wine, and set him on his own beast and brought him to an inn and took care of him. And on the morrow, when he departed, he took out 2 pence and gave it to the host and said unto him, take care of him, and whatsoever thou spendest more when I come, I will repay thee. Which now of these three thinkest thou was neighbor unto him that fell among the thieves? Obvious answer, verse 37, he that showed mercy on him. Then said Jesus unto him, this is the proof. What did he say? Go and do thou likewise. How do we wrap up this month? Give me just a few minutes, and I hope to give you an encouraging and challenging thought. In Luke chapter 10, Jesus gives us this parable about a man, obviously beaten, left for dead. He's in a helpless situation, not of his own choosing. Along the way, there are two religious people who know what God says, but because they can't be inconvenienced, I get there's a lot more to the passage there than that, but for time's sake, they will not be inconvenienced, they will not go out of their way, and therefore they go around a known situation that they could lend their hand to, just trusting somebody else will just have to do it. And then an unlikely character comes along, a Samaritan. We assume from Jesus' story that the man who's been beaten and laying in a ditch is Jewish. And a Samaritan comes along to see him. If you're not familiar with it, Samaritans were people who had been a part of the nation of Israel, had been relocated, had intermarried, and now were rejected by Israelis. So somebody that held great prejudice towards the man in the ditch, the man who should say, not my problem, you got what you deserved, and walk by, is the very one who does what? Has compassion on him. Here's what I want you to think about as we wrap it up, the Sanctity of Life month. Think about this next thought. Everyone wants it to be someone else's responsibility. I'm not trying to be unkind. I'm not trying to guilt trip anybody in here, though I'm good at it. You're welcome. Everyone always wants it to be someone else's responsibility, don't they? We see that in our account, and we see it in the culture around us. We hear about missions, but I need to pay off my house and pay off my car, and I need to get the kids' 529 plan, and so we can't be troubled with missions. That's not my responsibility. I'm on a Dave Ramsey plan right now. You got to understand, I can't give to missions. I got student loans. We hear about Dear Dinah, and that's a little scary. I'd have to walk and hang out and talk with police officers and maybe even prostitutes in the city I live in. I'd have to love people that I don't know where they've been or what they have. I hear about abortion. It's like, oh, I really don't want to be known as that guy at the office or that lady in the community that, oh, you're one of those folks. We want it to be everybody else's responsibility. Here in this passage, we see Jesus giving a very clear understanding about how we demonstrate if we're his follower or not. Check out the truth on the screen. You see it right there. Our willingness to act out of love for anyone demonstrates the validity of our faith in someone, the someone being Christ. I'm not saying you have done all you can do. I'm not saying you're liable for everything that needs to be done. What I am saying, and what Jesus is helping us with from this passage, is our willingness to act demonstrates if we really are or are not a follower. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying, well, you better be a foster care parent. No, that's maybe a specific application of this principle. But we can't act like there's not a need. We can't act like, not just in this sense, but any of the senses, that we don't have some opportunity, culpability, and honestly, obligation. We have this passage, and you see one man who shouldn't show his willingness to have compassion on somebody, even though he can't help himself and he doesn't deserve it, and he showed more faith than the other two who claimed to have faith. So if we're going to emulate that heart that Jesus said, that's love in my economy for your neighbor, let's recognize a few thoughts and we're out of here. First thought is this: blissfully unaware only lasts so long it is unrealistically tidy. Sometimes you grow up in a household, you never even heard the word foster kid. You never even heard the word streetwalker. You've never heard the word welfare. You've never heard the word, and on we could go with whatever word or stereotype. And we think, oh my goodness, that's because, and we fill in a very tidy blank. Oh, you're on food stamps? Probably lazy. Oh, you need to be in foster care? What'd you do? Or what are your parents? What losers are they? And if we're not careful, we live either blissfully unaware or we try to keep a really tidy idea about life, and that's not reality. Our sister said it, life is what? It is messy. You just had to be married to know life is messy. Two sinners trying to live together under a roof together? Then you add other sinners to that equation? My goodness, right? You know that. Blissfully unaware only lasts so long and is unrealistically tidy. We as followers are called to engage our world. Second thought is this: everyone has excuses for why they can't help in some small way. I'm not asking you to climb the mountain. I'm just asking you to recognize the mountain's there and figure out how you can address your part of it. It doesn't matter what application it is in the sanctity of life. God has some way for you in some fashion to be engaged, involved. Whether that's just being knowledgeable, whether that's being engaged, whether that's acting on behalf of. Everyone may have an excuse of why they can't help, but that doesn't demonstrate the validity of our faith and walk with Jesus Christ. Third thought would be this: engagement means self-denial and sacrifice. Knowing is half, doing is required. That's the other half. In the account, the man gives of his effort, his time, his own safety, his money, and even a future obligation. We all know the most valuable asset that any of us have, it's not money, it's time. He was willing to give that then and beyond. My friends, when it comes to the issues of sanctity of life, no matter what specific application or arena it's in, engagement will mean self-denial and sacrifice. You know what that means for the average American family? Maybe your kid doesn't need to play sports because you need to minister in some way. See, that was a real failure. That was when a lot of parents just said, hallelujah, that's right. So we'll try that again. That may mean your kid doesn't get to play a particular season of sports. It's a little tepid, but we'll take it. We're going to take it and move on, right? Oh, you hate sports. No. I'm asking, what's going to matter in 30 years? Your kid being in all season, and they got a scholarship, and what did that mean? They learned leadership skills. Listen, what they learn in sports, they can learn anywhere else. Same is true working a job, anything else. You get what I'm saying? I'm not hating. I'm just trying to help us evaluate. Self-denial and sacrifice. It may mean, Dad, you don't have your Thursday game club. It may mean, Mom, you don't have your Friday whatever. You get the idea here? Self-denial and sacrifice calls me to ask, what am I doing with the most valuable asset, time, and how am I utilizing time to invest eternally in people? Through the church, into my community, absolutely. It's going to call you to say no to you and yes to someone else. And that's tough because we're prone to value them as less valuable than we value who? Us. Engagement means self-denial and sacrifice. Well, that seems a little staunch, Pastor. Well, it's staunch because Jesus expects this kind of love. I want you to consider, it's on the screen, Jesus expects this kind of love. Why? Because he enables that kind of love for his followers. You only understand the concept and enjoy the practice of love because he loved you first. He loved you unconditionally. He loved you sacrificially. Think about your sin and separation problem, my sin and separation problem. As I read my Bible this morning, Cain's like, not my problem, not my fault. Jesus said, it's not my problem, it's not my fault, but I'm going to make it my problem. And I'm not just going to make it my problem, I'm going to solve your problem for you. And you know what the good news is? He did. He did, right? He gave himself on your behalf and my behalf to offer forgiveness, to offer freedom spiritually. Yes, now and forever. So he expects this kind of love because he's the one who unlocked the door for you to experience this kind of love, to be the conduit for this kind of love in and through your life. My friends, the life of following Jesus isn't a have-to life, though sometimes we struggle in our flesh and it feels that way. It is a life we've been freed and he expects and calls us to. So everybody wants it to be somebody else's responsibility. The people who should be the most ready to step into those moments, though tough, are you and me as followers of Jesus. Nobody has capacity greater than you and I. What does Ephesians 2:10 say? You and I are created in Christ Jesus unto good works. They don't save. They don't forgive. They're simply the fruit or the evidence of being alive spiritually and freed from the power of sin. Forever, yes, but even today. My friends, I encourage you this morning as we wrap up Sanctity of Life Month. This isn't a guilt trip to say, and I better see 47 people sign up for foster care. I better see 28 volunteers at Dear Dinah or Mercy and Truth. Or you better be signing up with Create Equal. No. But it should stoke us to ask, in what way am I living out my life of faith and love to Jesus, to the world around me? We're going to pray, and I'm going to give you the opportunity after we pray to just have a moment, just a moment where we call an invitation, where we invite you to respond to what God stirred in your heart. And we're not going to believe, we're not going to make it longer. We just want to give you a moment to reflect. So I'm going to pray, and as I do, we'll have the instruments play, and we'll move towards our dismissal. Father, help us this morning. I know in my own heart, I'm always prone to decide it's somebody else's fault, somebody else's problem, somebody else's need, rather than ask, how have I been freed and equipped to follow Jesus in this? I pray that you give each of my brothers and sisters in the room clarity, encouragement, exhortation, and should it be required in your understanding, even admonishment if I need it or someone else needs it, that your Spirit would accomplish your work in our life. God, we're thankful for what we've heard this morning. Faith in action in the life of Sonda and Sterling. And I'm thankful that you will work in our lives the same way. Give us grace, we ask, in Christ's name. Amen.